Thanks very much, George. I had posted the blog post, and I've since seems to have lost it. It's somewhere back up in there in the chat, if somebody could try and scroll and get it. The blog post on George's blog that outlines more extensively George's notion of the curator. I've noted down a few comments and questions, George, and I'm sure others have too, but I may as well kick it off. Early on in the presentation, you suggested that the notion of guide on the side wasn't enough, and have obviously tried to answer that one to, with the idea of a curator. So if I understand it right, we might say have a course structure being the learning objectives and everything else like that, assessment criteria and things like that, but then the teacher would then put together an exhibition the same way a curator does and puts it on show, and then would leave it to the students to take the course structure or take the exhibition and apply it to the course structure. So to find one exhibit or one artifact and see how it fits in that particular learning objective and then go through the activities and modules and stuff like that. Is that essentially what you're saying as a better idea of guide on the side, assuming we all agree that Sage on the Stage is not as, or guide on the side is better than Sage on the Stage?
Well, and I think, yes, essentially what you presented there is what I'm seeking to put forward with this notion of curatorial teaching. And it came from, I think, and it's something I'm sure, Lee, you've been blogging active for quite a while, so you know the experience, but once you're online for a while, you realize this type of active, networked exchange of learning it really is a great way to learn. It's a great way to build global relationships. And yet, in our classrooms, though, we're mandated with certain things. Our advisory boards, the industry that we serve, wants us to achieve certain things. So we're at this point where online I can happily run through the blog meadows, experiencing a new source of information where I will. But when I get into a classroom, suddenly I have a particular intent. And so the point I put forward previously with this is, we have a challenge where we today need to achieve a centralized outcome, but we need to do so through decentralized means. And I think that's been a vital point that I've been trying to wrap my mind on, is how do I get a clear outcome through decentralized means? The guide on the side is one potential model, but a guide on the side doesn't allow for enough of that erosion of authority that's occurred through the ability for us to connect with numerous individuals from around the world or numerous experts. So the guide on the side, on the one hand, is too neutral, but on the second hand, is still too singular, whereas the erosion of authority that comes through distributed means of access is what enables us to guide students through the constructs or the curatorial, the exhibits, whatever you want to call it. And it might just be simply the reading list. I mean, that could be the curatorial product that we generate. As a result, these resources are made available for others, the learners, to go through. We're leading them through the set structure, and that's the point I'm making here with the key structure of a discipline. We're presenting that to them, but we're presenting it from a multiple perspectives, and we're giving them an opportunity to dissect it and experience it in different ways and at different levels. Does that sort of get to what you're asking, Lee?
Absolutely. It kind of affirms what I was thinking, and I've just brought to mind Dave Wiley's recent course on open content. I'm just going to try and grab the link. At least I've got his recent blog post. I'll put that one in there. He has compiled a course much the same way. He's name to the course, I think it's Open Educational Resources, and it deals with copyright and education and things like that. And in the wiki, he's just listed a schedule, and that would be what you'd call the exhibits, the curated exhibits, because in the schedule it has, here is a reading or two, here is a general global question that you might like to consider in your blog posts, and off you go, and then next week we do this next week. So it's quite a simple application of this model, and not too unfamiliar for most of us who have been through universities and things, but it's I found it a very refreshing course in its simplicity. It doesn't have lots of animations and videos and stuff. It's just a step-by-step guide going through good readings, or it does have good videos and audio and stuff like that. But essentially, the course is, as you say, an exhibit curated by Dave Wiley. Has anyone else got comments and questions they can chip in? I'll switch off the mic.
Yeah, hi, George. David here, David McQuillan. Just wondering, I guess traditionally a curator, or my understanding at least of a curator, is somebody who sets the scenes and then allows people to pass through the exhibition and gather their experience from that. So that seems to me to be a fairly passive role once the experience is undergone. Is that the way that you see the curator, someone who sets the scenes and then steps out of it and lets the students take it where they will, or do you see the curator being actively involved in that process?
That's a great question, David. I think the curator would, in my perspective, would need to be involved. And I'm looking at going back to the example that Lee just presented with David Wiley's course. David is not neutral in it. He plays the curatorial role of putting together these resources because he's the expert, so to speak. He might not necessarily like that title, but you know, he's largely recognized as an expert with regard to open content. And so he knows the field, he understands the history extremely well, and newcomers then benefit from that breadth of experience that he has. It gets back to the wayfinding slide that I threw up earlier. The wayfinding experience of newcomers can be significantly aided through the curatorial activities of someone like David Wiley in the field of open content. So the role of an educator still is one of engagement and dialogue and asking questions, directing learners in cases. In Clarence Fisher, the other, which I mentioned in the article, the counterpoint with Clarence Fisher is that of network administrator is the term that he uses for his role as a teacher. You know, in the classroom, his job is to make sure students are forming good networks, that they're creating networks that will aid them once they're beyond the classroom itself. So to combine the notion of curatorial teaching with the notion of the teacher as a network administrator, I think we have, at least for my sake, more of a holistic perspective on what needs to happen. We've been passive. Learners have been passive in the classroom for so long. We don't necessarily want to move the other side now where it's the teachers who are passive. It is a rich interplay where learners fortunately have access far beyond what they used to have with just the sole instructor in a classroom.
Barbara, please jump in with that. I'm also thinking that is while we on the one hand think or know it's a great way to learn this networked communication way, we all experience more than reluctant students on the idea.
My question is, networking nowadays is the buzzword and everybody wants to network and make the students network because this is the thing. What about students who do not feel like networking, right? I mean, they may have the reasons. If we say it's learner-centered and according to their own interest and what they're after, I mean, there may be students who are not interested in networking. So why do we push this on them?
I think the reluctance of students to do certain things is a valid concern that we do need to explore. I think we've got a bit of a concern with the word network, and you're quite right in saying it's a buzzword. We've beaten it to death. But if you consider what did we previously, 20 years ago, used to do when students came into a classroom? We did the same thing. We networked. We took them and we would say, okay, here's Dostoevsky, read this text. Go over here and now you'll encounter this particular piece of literature. Now you'll encounter this author. So we were networking getting our students to network with ideas. And now, and these ideas were under the exclusive control of the educator in the classroom or the curriculum committee that decided what it was that they would encounter. So with that background, students then still had a network forming process of developing their own understanding by piecing together these numerous authors, these numerous ideas that they came together. So networking isn't new. Networking isn't, getting back to the term giveness, it's not something that technology doesn't give us networking. I think human nature gives us networking. When we write a letter 100 years ago, there was a networking component present there as well. What we're talking about here when we include technology in the process is that we need to, or we have the ability to significantly ramp up that opportunity, to significantly improve the student's ability to form those networks or to form those connections, if that's a term that causes slightly less offense. But I think it is important to acknowledge network learning is not new at all. It is significantly heightened in prominence because we now have tools that can make the connection the explicit intent rather than perhaps the understanding that may have been an intent previously. But by making it the explicit intent, we also have the corresponding ability, as I mentioned earlier, the erosion of authority in a classroom where students can now learn from many individuals.
If I could jump in there on Cormac's point. Actually, I shouldn't actually. Cormac's got a microphone. For some reason, I thought Cormac didn't have a microphone. Please jump in there, Cormac.
I'd be happy for you to just pick up on the point because really, I kind of said what I was, you know, what I typed into the field there about people having this reluctance to share their ideas in a public space because, you know, we deal with public space, or at least I do all the time in a wiki, and I know that people are actually scared, you know, to death sometimes of just even pressing that edit button and putting in their details, and, you know, any opinion that's shared is in the public domain, and, you know, you need to think a lot more about that when you actually share your ideas in that kind of context. So it's a whole context that we need to be sensitive to and not just think of it as a barrier that we need to get through, but just as a very real part of human nature and participation, you know?
I do agree that there's two big distinctions there, though, and I think you mentioned that in your text point. The forming networks is obviously quite different from being transparent in our learning. I think we've always had students who were afraid to stand up and give a presentation in a classroom environment, and we today have learners who don't want to post their comments in a public forum. So I think there are different aspects that are involved in different approaches to learning, and definitely they change based on age level as well. I was looking, trying to get a hold of an individual today who I wanted to chat about or to chat with, and a fairly prominent person, but I couldn't find an online presence anywhere for him. You know, he's largely managed to keep his identity completely underground. You can't get a hold of his email address or anything. I had a former chief technology officer when I was at Red River College. The same way, he managed to completely shield his identity. So, but that's different from learning. If we look at, if we take that aside, they may be active in listservs that they're comfortable with. They may be active in small communities. But as teachers, yeah, we do need to be attentive to what is it that causes learners to push back at how we want to use technology.
I'm kind of thinking this problem or conundrum can, or the solution to it perhaps, or one of them, relates to the problem we have with the digital divide and things. It's something I've been meaning to research a bit more about, to look at the possibilities. And that is to bridge the gap between the digital media and the analog media, for one. So looking at the podcast movement, for example, and getting a radio show that, perhaps a talkback radio show that will play the podcast but then take the telephone calls from people and turn them into podcasts back to the digital arena. But then thinking a similar parallel in the face-to-face classes, we might continue to run face-to-face classes for those who are particularly averse to the idea of communicating online and taking an open identity like that. They can continue to communicate in a small 10 to 15 people group or more, And then the teacher or the curator plays the role of bridging between the two. And I think that would be complementary to ideas of digital divide. I think, in short, I think that this issue relates to digital divide. Some people may have an ethical, moral, or practical reason for not being online and not wanting their identities to be exposed online, similarly to people who just don't have the infrastructure around them to participate online. So that teacher's obviously going to have to bridge that accessibility gap, and that might be one strategy on how to manage that.
No, I fully agree, Lee, and I think there's a lot of opportunities now to really start to mess with our understanding of how we ought to teach or how we ought to learn or how we are learning in this type of an environment, whether it's the breakdown, as you mentioned, the digital analog, which is sort of the core root. We do still need to acknowledge that there's an awful lot of challenge happening how would I put it? We need to be fully conscious of the fact that there is going to be increased turbulence in the nature and attributes of our learners. We're going to start to see, as more and more people get increasingly proficient with technology, we'll start to see the gap stretching out. The differences will be much more remarkable, if you will, than what they currently are. And as educators, we will need to attend to the full spectrum of traits, skills, and interests. So we will have those who are quite happy with their blog, their podcast, their Facebook, their whatever identities, and those who wish to remain completely anonymous. That's, I think, an important one that is a good idea for us to continue to be acutely aware of.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's... I think it's a welcome challenge from my end of the spectrum. I think it is something that could be achieved. Yes, it would be a lot of extra pressure to begin with, but I think it could be possible to become used to it. And again, looking at Dave Wiley's model, I think looking at that ultra-simple model could easily bridge between a face-to-face private group and with an open network. Indeed, the two could be quite complementary.
Well, I think one of the I had an interesting experience this weekend. There was a college or a young college, which is I guess basically a hairstyling college. We did a little bit of work with on some of their how they were going to be teaching their material. And here's an individual who doesn't have experience with technology necessarily beyond email, but has a rich understanding of what it means to be, I guess, a good teacher basically. And what she had done is put together this incredible curriculum where she's teaching hair styling at a distance, which means her learners, they've got their little camera set up on their laptop. They've got the little mannequin heads or whatever they use. They've got a series of videotapes. There's two-way dialogue where they'll demonstrate to the instructor how they're styling particular hair. Then there's this backflow here where there's a high level of dialogue. And I think what surprised me is sometimes we find really interesting ideas in places we aren't expecting them. And any educator who is passionate about teaching well, I think, I'm trying not to make this too much of a loaded statement, but I think will be able to use technology well because their goal is learning. It's not about control or it's not about a certain scheme of arrangement in a classroom. So here's this individual who wasn't necessarily very technologically proficient, but she had a very elaborate thought-out scheme using digital cameras, using the two-way just webcams for interacting with her students, DVD players for interacting with or observing the content. It's just a great example of when we are committed to teaching well or when we're committed to a high standard of learning, it informs all of the decisions that we make subsequent.
There's lots to think about. I'm certainly motivated to go further with writing up my thinking about this. Does anybody else have some questions or comments or another tangent to take us on? Well, it's hard to take the silence. George, is there something else you'd like to touch on out of this conversation? Otherwise, we might come close to wrapping it up. It's a nice, short, concise session for people in lunchtime over here. But we've got 15 minutes up our sleeve as far as the Illuminate booking goes. So is there any question your end, George, that you'd like to ask of us?
Well, I guess for myself, there is a lot of interplay here on, and keep in mind, you know, a lot of these tools allow us to be very public in our formation of our own ideas, our own thoughts. So whereas previously someone would have an idea, if you will, and they might present it at a few small conferences, or they might talk to colleagues about it, they might read literature, and then, you know, 2 years down the road it would hit a journal, and then it would be a complete, well thought out, well reasoned idea. What we're finding today is we can throw out these half-baked ideas and we can have dialogue almost immediately. In some cases the ideas have legs and are adopted by others, in other cases they're not. So I think with the notion of curator, that's and I highly doubt that it's a unique concept. I'm sure others have had similar distinctions, maybe not use the same language. But I'm interested in just getting a better understanding of what happens when we become a community, not just a classroom, where let's say we have a discipline where we have a lot of individuals that are involved, almost a community of practice model, but you know, what's the role of curators in that kind of an open or in that more you know, peer-based group? There is an assumption in a classroom that the teacher, even though they might not hold the reins of an expert status the way they once did, they're still a prominent force in that classroom. When we get into these online spaces, for example, we have with a lot of people who are involved here, I imagine most of you, or a good portion of you, probably have some form of relationship with each other, who might belong to different online communities. So I think that's one of the questions I'd like to hear anyone's thoughts on it is, how does a curator or the curatorial function, the arrangement for effect or the revelation of key structure, what happens when we move into a community-based environment? Does anybody want to throw out thoughts relating to that?
I just stuck a couple of things up there. This is Bron here. I think you start acting as a bit of a mediator or a negotiator because, and I mean, of course, facilitator. But basically, you're not going to have the community running smoothly at all times. There's different personalities involved. And so you do have to be fairly skilled at seeing both sides and making sure everybody has a fair go, I think.
I guess, Bron, that depends on whether or not we or the curator feels pressure to have everybody on a certain list, you know, the class role or whatever, to be engaged. Maybe there's a difference there, and that somehow with this model, we can afford to have people come and go, and it's a little bit like this Illuminate session. You know, some people are quite happy just to listen in, or maybe they're doing other things while this is being talked about in the background, and perhaps we can be comfortable with that. I'm just thinking more about this course that we've set up here. You know, the 10-minute lectures that we're getting here are an exhibition in some way. And then the individual lecturers, such as George here, is an exhibition in his own right. So we've almost got curators within curators. So somebody has organized this series of lectures that people can listen in on. And then the individual lecturers have organized a series of content within an exhibitionist, within their particular time slots for us to look at the number of links and the number of ideas and things like that. And then I guess where it comes back to what you said, Bron, is, yeah, trying to, the facilitators trying to support people in how to perhaps reflect about those things, getting comfortable on writing something to their blog or not, trying to motivate engagement. But personally, I'd hope that we can find a model where if I'm a facilitator, I don't feel pressure of getting everybody on a list engaged and passed somehow. I know that's not quite the climate we're working in at the moment as far as the centralized learning model, but hopefully we can get there by finding a new model along these lines.
Hi, there's been an interesting discussion, George, in CP Square with Beth Cantor and the NP Tech community, which is very democratic, very dispersed across multiple technologies. And they've even, you know, they're part of our question of is there a there in social network communities. But they found the need for someone to step in and work as curator because it was all so dispersed and so spread, and there was need for someone to help provide the trail for newbies coming in. And it's been an interesting experience listening to what Beth had to say, and she's blogged about some of this, so it'll be easy to find if you want to look up some of her experience.
Okay, and I'm, you know, while you're having this discussion there, one of the, because we refer to, usually when we talk about a curator, we refer to it as an object, and we typically assume, or at least I think that's sort of the undertone of our conversation, that the job of a curator is to curate content, and Lee sort of started touching a little bit on it that there's maybe a, you know, a different dimension to it. I think curatorial teaching also involves, hopefully this makes some sense, but curating the conversation. There are certain things that we can do with content, because nowadays especially we have far more opportunity for learners to not just consume content, which is, I think, one of the dangers of saying curatorial teaching, is that, well, then the learner once again becomes this being that absorbs the content that someone has created. And yet today we know that there's much more involved dialogue, or when someone creates something, someone comes by and recreates it. They, you know, they take it, they adjust it, they mix it, they create something entirely new with it if there's the right avenue or the openness that allows people to build on each other's work. So I think that's an important one to also, to not lose that concept that it's not about the learner only walking paths set by the individual, the curator. It's about the learner being able to engage with and to adjust and to change and actively recreate these structures that have been created by or have been arranged by the original, the instructor or the teacher. So it's beyond just content. It's also about recreating. It's also about having individuals actively involved in conversations with each other, because obviously it's the conversations that then result in the creation of new content.
Yeah, I think the trick is there in allowing the flexibility, but still managing to ensure that your students can meet their learning outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that gets right back down to the concept of how do we achieve a centralized aim, you know, a clear aim through decentralized means. And if we have our learners actively involved in doing things, I think that's always a better mode of learning as well, rather than, you know, passively interacting or passively observing what reading the articles that the instructor has put together for them to observe. It's about having them think about it, do it, recreate it, rewrite it, reconnect it, make something new out of the overall process.
Bron touches on the discussion that we had on your blog, George, about as curators in a class, do we take care of participants? And the comment I was trying to add to George's post before was, you know, as much as it may be annoying, the distinction in the roles, say a curator may be responsible for compiling good content together, even though George says that it's more about that, more than about that. Whereas a facilitator or a mentor will help people negotiate the content and help them relate the content to their learning objectives. So I guess the metaphor of curator goes further in that it's the metaphor of the museum and an art gallery, in that there is an expert who will put together an exhibition because they see some worth in it, and then there are the guides in the gallery who employ different strategies, as Cormac points out, more participatory activities and stuff to help people interpret that sort of stuff and relate it to what they've come for.
Yeah, and I think we had a very brief exchange on your blog, I think, on this. And really, whether we give it a particular name that has individual functions assigned to it, let's say, you know, I use the term the curatorial teaching, and if we say, well, there's the arranging of resources, or there's the fostering of conversations, or there's the whatever else that goes with it, or whether we take, and as you did with your post, you split out the different roles where you then have the facilitator who maybe picks up somewhere from what the curator has done, or it might be the same person just playing different roles and giving it a different name. I think these are definitely important distinctions to be made that reflect the holistic model of teaching. So whether we're inclined to give them distinct names or just assume that they're subsets of a main title, I don't think is really the critical issue. I think what's more important is that we're understanding that there's a variety of roles and activities that we're going to continue to play in our classrooms or in our digital classrooms. And there's just a quick point, our thought leaders, curators that Bron threw out in the discussion forum, I would suggest very much could be. I'd like to hear other individuals' thoughts on that, though, but I think a curator isn't – I'm trying to get the notion of much more activity than simply looking at – because when we assume in a traditional museum sense, the curator isn't the one who made the pot or who created this lovely artifact. We assume they're the ones that just organize the artifacts. So I don't know if we have to get to a notion of a pottery-making curator without completely diluting the notion of a curator as being absolutely everything, because that's not going to do us any good either. We start losing the distinct functions that we have there.
George, you could actually see the curator as being the more passive, but the students in the class as being the ones that are active. I mean, there is that way of looking at it as well. And I'm not actually keen on that idea, because I do think the facilitator should be participating and helping build the activities and taking the slack. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I think there was someone who right at the start had a disagreement with me. I'm not sure exactly what it was relating to, but if I'm not sure who that was either right now. But if whoever that was, I'm not sure if it was related to what we were going to talk about here, or if it was a point I just made right at the start, or if you just generally disagree with me in my entire – oh, that was Dave, that Cormier guy. Oh, I got to get him. Anyway, okay, anyone who has a – you know, there's always nice to have opposing viewpoints.
Hi George, it's Megan. I've just got a query. This idea of the curator seems to be based on the premise that there is a whole heap of information out there, and I think relevant to the subject that you're studying, and I think that's true in many areas. But I work in massage education, and I find that there actually isn't a lot of quality content out there on the net. I've looked around, and still most of the good stuff is still in textbooks and in the courses in course material. So how do you see this idea relating to that sort of scenario?
So if I've interpreted you correctly, you're just asking a scenario where there is not a lot of quality information available. You know, what happens in that kind of an environment. And if I've interpreted correctly, it's a great question. I don't know exactly what that would look like. I do know, and this is part of the intention that I had in initially throwing it out, and I know B mentioned that she doesn't like the name curator, so by all means, brainstorm away. The intent was the abundance of information is consuming our attention, and so we get to the point where we're spending so much of our time actively involved in simply trying to manage the information that we're not in the point of making sense of it. So our attention is continually distracted by what's new, and our attention is less focused on deep understanding. So when you're and I was just read a, I think it was a computer sciences professor at Stanford University, I think in 1985 or something, decided to stop using email in 1990. He said he'd been using it since 75 and he was done with email. Everything now is by paper correspondence because he required deep thinking in order to be able to do the work that he needed to do. So with a curator, the thought was someone who helps make that act of wayfinding simpler for learners. So even environments where there is a lack of information, maybe one of the roles that an individual there plays is providing the best of information, namely finding and presenting the limited information that exists. The individuals might not be able to locate the information as such, namely if they might not know which databases to go, or they might not know the reputable documents or articles. So even in environments of scarcity, a curator can still play the role of bringing these resources to learners' attention that they might not encounter typically. Well, Lee, I've got an 8 o'clock, well, my time, 8 o'clock, which is in 2 minutes from now. I have another session I need to meander into. So I thank you for the invitation to chat with your group here, and thank you for the questions and the comments put forward by participants, and take care.
Many thanks, George. Many thanks. It was quite a fast hour for me. I've caught myself looking out the window thinking about what you're saying, and I totally lost track of time. So thanks for joining us, George. I think you've given us a lot to think about. I'm really quite inspired by this analogy, and from there I think I can draw out lots of processes and series or scheduling of activities and things like that along that analogy. So thanks a lot, George, and look forward to reading more on your blog. If people in the course want to stick around, or even our guests want to stick around and listen to what we talk about, maybe we could use this opportunity to talk a bit further, although in the past, usually we aren't really in the mood to talk too much more about the course after such a thought-provoking presentation. Bron, are we going to regularly schedule meeting times aside from these 1 hour, these 10-minute lectures? I think you were proposing Monday nights, so I'm a little bit behind on that.
Yeah, the group agreed at one stage on Monday evenings at 7:30. So don't forget, we've got 2 weeks holidays. That doesn't stop the group working on things amongst themselves, but I think the next scheduled Monday night, there'll be 2 weeks' time, will be the 8th of October. Okay.
All righty. And I'm not sure if Sean Fitzgerald's presentation about virtual worlds went ahead in the end. Did that happen at all? Or should we reschedule that? And I think that Sean would be the last person, if he hasn't spoken already, that I've lined up as far as guest lectures go. I could go ahead and line some more people up, or we could take a break and sort of reorganize ourselves around the wiki project.
Sean didn't go ahead, and he's offered, and he said he was going to talk with you. He's got offered to actually facilitate the next session actually in the Second Life. So we need to get people organized on there. So I guess it'll be November sometime. I have asked Derek Chernside to do a session on the 15th of October, and I can't recall what the name of it was now. And also Merrily was going to do a bit of a session on her research that she did with blogs and wikis and with health practitioners. So I haven't thought of any others yet, but yeah, I think we should have some regular speakers carrying on.
Okay, no worries. We can schedule a few more. I think after our conversation last night, I came to realize that there are lots of other dimensions to online as far as communities go that we could still explore. I'd really like to hear from a group, for example, working or playing in World of Warcraft, and hear about how they facilitate their kind of learning and their communications and stuff like that, as well as people from the likes of Facebook or whatever. So it's something we'd keep on the boil, I suppose. As far as Sean goes, let's just wait until we've all got on the same page as far as installing Second Life on our computers, and and take it from there, I guess, a little bit after our wiki activities.
Yeah, that sounds good. It looks like everybody's disappearing anyway, so maybe we should wrap up.
Oh yeah, no worries. Just grabbing the opportunity to talk to you. I haven't seen you for a while. I'll hit stop on the record, Ben, and I'll have these up in the